flashlights. That came direct to the house. Currently, it showed Patty and Shorty heading for the mouth of the track, in a straight line, with the burning motel directly behind them, no doubt. Smart. It had never been thought of. Not in any of their brainstorming sessions. Not in any of their simulations. It should have been thought of. Night vision or no night vision, they would be very hard to see against a bright, moving glare directly behind them. Not until they were very close. His final problem was customer number 3's heart rate monitor. It was sounding an alarm. Not a necessary piece of equipment, but part of the terms and conditions. A private experiment run by Robert, who wanted to test the notion that the thrill of the hunt was in the chase. He thought not, based on experience in Thailand. He thought the thrill came in the delicious hour after the prey was cornered. He wanted numbers to prove it. Hence, customers were to wear monitors. Data was to be recorded. So far, number 3 had displayed increasing excitement, with a recent, huge peak. And then he had flatlined. According to his monitor, he was dead. Chapter 38. Patty and Shorty held hands, and somehow the palm-to-palm contact was better than talking when it came to saying what they had to say. They were both feeling weird. Somewhere between paralyzed and frantic, sometimes breathless, caught up in a strange double flip-flop inversion. It was pitch dark, so they were safe. Except for night vision, so they weren't. Except night vision couldn't be used, so they were. One step, they felt secure. Like little kids, hiding. They could see no one, therefore no one could see them. The next step, they felt they were walking the length of a gigantic airport runway, two tiny figures all alone in the vastness, lit up by 1,000 probing searchlights. They didn't know which feeling was real. Maybe neither. They walked on. They waited for arrows. None came. They anticipated sentries wide on the flanks, impatient types, hoping for the best, hoping for early contact. They planned to avoid them by coming in pretty much centrally, pretty much halfway between any two distant outposts, with the fire behind them every step. But then at the last moment they planned to veer off course, just as far as the edge of the blaze would cover them. Then they would work around in the woods and pick up the track's direction a little farther down. Better than walking right in, they thought. Surely the mouth of the track would be watched very carefully. Also, they planned to split up, just temporarily, just by 10 yards or so. Close enough to help, Patty said. Then she thought, far enough to get away when the other one is killed. But out loud she said, far enough not to make one big target. In the distance behind them, the motel's roof fell in. A huge cloud of sparks rose up, and hungry new flames started in on the timbers. The fire was brighter than ever. Now, Patty said. They went south, to their right. They skipped along sideways, glancing ahead, glancing back at the fire, trying to stay covered by its white-out glow, by the very last edge of its halo, but also pushing the envelope, going as wide as they dared, and then wider, and wider still. And then Shorty ran for the woods first, as agreed. He made it. Patty waited. No sound. No shouted warning. She went after him, squeezing between the same two trees, aiming to head around the same quarter circle, back toward the track. She could hear him up ahead. She was close enough to help. She glanced behind her. She was far enough to get away. Would she? She thought, a mile in my shoes, baby. Who knew what anyone would do? She walked on. Then two things happened so fast and sudden her mind went blank. They came out of nowhere. Too fast to see. Two things happened. That was all she knew. And then nothing. Except Shorty was suddenly standing in front of her, and a guy was lying on the ground. Then came a painful slow-motion replay, like a mental reaction. Maybe a therapeutic purpose. Post-traumatic. In her mind, she saw a guy looming up. Literally a nightmare vision. All in black. Tight nylon. A bow. An arrow. A hideous mechanical one-eyed face. The bow jerking right, tilting down at her legs, aiming low. They'll shoot to wound. Then the string drawing back, the arrowhead winking in the moonlight. Then out of nowhere, Shorty was behind the guy, swinging his long metal flashlight like the riot police, hitting the guy full on behind the ear, every ounce of his potato farmer bulk and muscle behind it, plus every ounce of his anger and fury and fear and humiliation. The guy went straight down. Dead, she was sure. The sound alone told her. The flashlight against his skull. She was a country girl. She had heard enough cows killed to know what it took. Close enough to help. It had worked. "Thank you," she said. "I busted my flashlight," he said. "It doesn't turn on anymore." "You can have mine," she said. "It's the least I can do." "Thank you." "You're welcome." "Keep mine for a weapon," he said. They traded flashlights. An absurd little ceremony. "Thank you," she said again. "You're welcome." She looked away. "But," she said. "But what?" "They know there are two of us. They must have known we would play it like that." "I guess." "Which is a risk for them." "I guess." "They must have known that up front." "Okay. I think their obvious solution would be to hunt in pairs."
A voice said, "Damn right about that, little girl."
They turned around. Another nightmare vision. Glistening black nylon tight to the skin. A complicated bow lurid with composite layers. A steel arrowhead as big as a serving spoon. A cyclops stare through an expressionless glass circle. The nightmare vision shot Shorty in the leg. The bowstring thumped. The arrow hissed, and Shorty screamed and went down like he had fallen through a trap door. The arrow was stuck in his thigh. He was hauling on it, and jerking his head side to side, and clamping his jaw up and down, which bit his scream into separate, rapid-fire gasps of agony, much faster than breathing, ah, 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 like a racing heartbeat. Patty was calm, like Shorty had been before, when her mind was blank. Now his was. Suddenly, she thought, this is how life is supposed to feel. She heard herself in her head, as if she was her own teammate, at her own shoulder, saying, sure, Shorty's bad, but he won't get any worse in the next 3 seconds. Not medically possible. So feel free to take care of the other thing first. Which was the guy with the bow, who was old, she saw. Suddenly, a second teammate was at her other shoulder, saying, sure, you're going to notice more now, much more detail, because now you're operating at a higher level, or maybe a more primitive level, where senses are more acute, so that although the guy is dressed head to toe in shiny black and has a machine on his face, you can tell from his posture and his movements he's about our grandfather's age. And he's stooped, and he's sparrow-chested, and if we think back to all the older guys we've known, uncles and great-uncles and so on, and the lousy shape they were in, and we adjust for height and weight, then maybe we don't have much to worry about with this guy. He was slow with his reload. His right elbow was slow to bend. Kind of awkward. Arthritis, maybe. He tried to compensate by scrabbling for the arrow early. He fumbled it. Patty breathed in. She felt she was at the head of a tight V-shaped formation. Somehow, now in motion, loud music playing, her loyal teammates marching at her shoulder, willing her on, bearing her forward, buoying her up, making her weightless. The first teammate whispered, I think the thing to remember, when all is said and done, apart from anything else, is that this guy shot Shorty with an arrow. which by any standards is completely out of order. The second teammate said the night vision device will protect his face. Better to aim for his throat. Keep mine for a weapon, Shorty had said. She did it beautifully, despite very little prior experience. She felt it all happen at a molecular level. She sensed every compound flooding her brain. Some were complex emotions, mostly about Shorty. Primeval feelings. Much stronger than she expected. Some were simple software downloads. Dusty old how-to manuals, left behind from savage eras deep in prehistory. She absorbed them all, and they gave her animal grace, and strength, and speed, and cunning, and ferocity, plus some kind of serene human abandon over the top of it all that made her surrender to instinct completely. She danced across the space, trailing the flashlight behind her, shuffling her stride to perfection, swinging the flashlight ahead of her, accelerating it hard, keeping it low, the cyclops eye coming down to track it, then whipping it up in a savage U-shaped curve into the narrowing angle between the dropping chin and the arching neck. It hit with a crunch she felt all the way to her elbow. The guy went down like he ran into a clothes rope. He landed on his back. She grabbed his bow and threw it away. His night vision was bound to his head with thick rubber straps. She tore it off. He was a thin, pale, sour man, about 70 years old. His mouth was opening and closing like a goldfish, panic in his eyes. He couldn't breathe. He pointed to his throat. Both hands, desperate, urgent gestures. Can't breathe, he mouthed. Tough shit, she thought. Then she heard Shorty whimper. Later she knew she would have no defense if a lawyer accused her of flying into a murderous rage. Damn right she did. Or if he asked her sternly, did you in fact beat the victim to death with the flashlight? Damn right she did. With blows to the head exclusively, a lot to his face, with every ounce of her strength, until his skull looked like a bag of nails. Then she crawled back to Shorty, who was quiet. He had seen. First things first, she got her hands under his arms and dragged him deeper into the woods. She got him sitting upright against a tree. She got his legs straight out in front. Then she ran back to the guy she had killed. She took his night vision device. She strapped it on. She hated it. It smelled of his breath and his hair, and dirty metal, and perished military rubber. But now she could see, luminous green, in fantastic detail. Every vein in every leaf on every tree was sharp as a pin. As if lit from inside, glowing softly. At her feet she saw every twig and every fallen flake of bark with exquisite precision. In the far distance, she saw trees just as bright as the trees close by. It was better than daylight. It was unnatural. It was amplified and smoothed and gated and displayed. She felt like Superman. She ran back to Shorty and got to work. Reacher took the dead guy's night vision device. He strapped it on and adjusted the buckles. The world went bright and green and highly detailed. He took the whole quiver of arrows. He slung it over his shoulder. 20 knives on sticks. Better than nothing. He moved deeper into the woods. No danger of getting lost. The track was still visible through the trees, even though it was now 30 yards to his left. It still showed clearly. Its luminosity was exactly equal to everything else. The night vision ignored shadow and distance. Every single thing got the same green and meticulous attention. He moved up 4 paces and stopped. He figured the second guy would be close, but not too close. Near enough for a rapid response, far enough to escape a train wreck. Within earshot, certainly. He turned a long, slow circle. He examined every detail. Night vision was not the same thing as thermal imaging. That was a different department entirely. If the guy lit a cigarette with a match, then sure, he would show up as a sudden bright flare. But solely because of the light, not the heat. Night vision didn't know about heat. If the guy didn't light a cigarette, he wouldn't really show up at all. Certainly not as a fat orange sausage of body temperature. At best, he would show up as a pale ghostly shape the same as every other pale ghostly shape. Or not show up. He was automatically camouflaged, because everything was green. No sign of him. Reacher checked the other side of the track. He moved back and forth to see through the trees. 50 yards away, easy. Perfect detail. Better than daylight. No light and shade. No dappling. No near and far. Each tree glowed exactly the same, as if equally radioactive. In some nightmare future world, each vine and bramble was a separate, delicate line, impossibly thin, like engraving on a banknote. He saw the guy. Leaning on a tree, about 6 feet from the edge of the track, skin-tight clothing, dark in color, bow in his hand, looking mostly forward up the track, but glancing back all the time, down the track, behind him. He was anxious. He couldn't hear his partner. Now, he had to choose. Respond? Or dodge a train wreck? He was 40 yards from Reacher, which implied some cautious stalking. For one of them, anyway. A painstaking task. Laborious. Reacher stood still. Sometimes he believed in letting the other guy do the work. First, he took a second arrow from the quiver, one in each hand. Then he chose a tree, a thick, strong specimen, about 60 years old, he thought, judging by Ryantown. He put his shoulder against it. He was a little thicker front to back than it was side to side. But it was close enough. He ranged away a step and squatted down. He used the arrow in his right hand to beat and batter and scythe through the undergrowth, big dramatic sweeps of his arm, intended to replicate the sound of a staggering man falling over, maybe rolling, maybe thrashing around. It was maybe convincing, maybe not. It could have been rare mammals meeting. So to perfect the illusion, he added a loud, strangled, gasping groan, as if in terrible pain, part stoic, part pleading, in a voice he hoped was like a guy as handsome as a movie actor. Then he straightened up and stood sideways behind his tree. He waited 2 whole minutes. He thought the guy wasn't fooled. But then he heard him, close by, very quiet, slow and steady, exactly on line. He was a good stalker. He was probably right-handed. Therefore, the bow would be in his left. The bow would be thrust forward, half ready. The string would be halfway back. Not slack. Not tight. An awkward posture. He would be leading with his left shoulder and walking half sideways. Reacher waited. The guy got slower. Now he was close to where he thought he heard the noise. He was anxious. But cautious, too. He called out in a fierce whisper, "Hey, four, are you there?" Reacher didn't move. The guy said, "Where are you, man? I think I lost you somewhere along the way. We need to get moving. We got something on fire up there." South Texas, Reacher thought. A polite, sincere voice. He kicked the brambles at his feet. The guy said, "Four, is that you?" Reacher didn't move. The guy said, "Are you hurt?" As a reply, Reacher made a quiet sound in the back of his throat. He guessed the nearest word in English would be air, said long and breathy. The guy crept closer and closer. He came around Reacher's tree, leading with his far shoulder, his belly exposed, looking through a tube, which in many ways was a technical marvel, with only one significant negative, which was a lack of extreme peripheral vision, which meant the guy came half a step too far around the tree. Before he saw. Before he froze. Reacher stabbed him with the arrow, a vicious uppercut high in the stomach, hard enough to bury the arrow up to Reacher's fist, hard enough to lift the guy up off his feet. Reacher let go of the arrow and whipped his hand back. The guy collapsed on his knees. The arrow was sticking out of his gut, sloping down. Maybe 6 inches of shaft, and then the feathers. The guy pitched forward on his face. He landed square on the feathers. The arrowhead punched out his back. It looked wet and slimy. Not red. Green, of course. Stephen had lost one of the flashlights. The GPS had blinked off and never returned. An impact, possibly. Currently, the surviving flashlight was 60 feet in the forest, 60 yards from the track. It had not moved for many minutes. He didn't know why. But his bigger worry was the heart rate monitors. Now 4 had flatlined. Now 4 of their customers were technically dead. Which was obviously insane. It was an equipment fault. Had to be. But better safe than sorry. Maybe someone should go take a look. The GPS showed Peter and Robert widely separated on the flanks at the edge of the forest. Still in neutral mode. Not interfering, there for advice and reassurance alone. Only if called upon, nothing more. Mark was moving, in a wide loop back toward the buildings. Not fast. He was either walking or riding slow on his bike. Too slow. They all needed to get moving. He needed to tell them. But he couldn't. The radio hub had burned up. Their earpieces were useless. They were hearing nothing, therefore doing nothing. Watching the fire, maybe. Then, the surviving flashlight started to move. Chapter 39. Shorty's pants leg was soaked with blood. Paddy couldn't tear the fabric. Too wet, too heavy, too slippery. She ran back and got an arrow. She used the edge of its head to widen the slit the first arrow had made. The new arrow was sharp. It was as good as a kitchen knife. She opened a length about 6 inches either side of the wound. She peeled back the sticky fabric. She took a look. The wound was vertical. The arrow had come in with one tang up and one tang down, and it had hit above his knee, about a third of the way up his thigh. Dead on central. It had speared through muscle and hit bone. She wasn't a doctor, but she knew the words. Through the quadriceps to the femur. 90 degrees from the femoral artery. Not even close. He wasn't going to bleed to death. They had been lucky. Except she was pretty sure the impact of the arrow had broken the bone. She felt around. There was a ledge-shaped lump on the back of his leg. Like a displaced fracture. His hamstrings were pushed out of place. He was gasping and groaning, muted, teeth clamped and moaning, partly with pain, partly with fury. He was pale green in the night vision. In shock, but not all the way. His heartbeat was fast, but steady. She studied the arrow she had used to cut the cloth. The head was a simple triangle. 2 wicked edges came together at the point. The body thickened gracefully in the middle to seat the shaft. To add weight and momentum. The edges were like razors. They would slice through anything. But there were no barbs. The edges would slice right back out again just as easily. Not even slice. No further damage. The pathway was already cut. Except Shorty's muscle had spasmed and clamped down hard. It was gripping the arrow like a vice. She said, "Shorty, I need you to relax your leg." He said, "I can't feel my leg. I think it's broken. That can't be good. I need to get you to the hospital. But first I need to pull the arrow out. Right now you're gripping it. You need to let it go.
I got no control. All I know is it hurts like hell.
She said, I think we really need to pull it out.
Try rubbing the muscle, he said, like I had a cramp.
She rubbed. His thigh was cold and wet and slippery, thick with blood. He groaned and gasped and whimpered. She squeezed both sides of the wound, inching the web of her thumb closer and closer to the arrowhead, and then she pressed a little harder, both sides, gaping the wound, opening it like a mouth. Blood welled up and spilled out in little green rivers, some one way, some the other.
Tell me where we're going, she said.
Florida, he said.
What will we do when we get there?
Windsurfers.
What else?
T-shirts, he said. Where the money is.
What kind of design?
He paused a moment, thinking, maybe something elaborate. And she gripped the arrow's shaft and jerked it as sharp and hard as she would getting a stuck 2x4 out of a rack at work. The arrow came out and Shorty shrieked between grinding teeth, with pain and outrage and betrayal.
Sorry, she said.
He gasped, and he panted. She slipped off her jacket and used the clean arrowhead to cut off the sleeves. She tied them together, end to end, with a generous knot. She folded the body of the jacket into a tight little pad, as small as she could get it. She pressed it down on the wound. She tied it on with the double sleeves. As good as she could get right then. A pressure dressing on the front to stop the bleeding, and a splint of sorts on the back. The big knot would hold things steady, at least for a while. She hoped. Wait there, she said. She ran back to the first nightmare figure, the one Shorty had hit, the crack behind the ear. She pulled off his night vision device. Its rubber straps were slick with blood. She took another arrow from the quiver. She ran back to Shorty. She gave him the headset to wear and the arrow to hold, for security, as a last-ditch defense.
Now, I'm going to find us a quad bike, she said.
She took the working flashlight in one hand and the clean arrow in the other. She ran back to Shorty's guy. She stood where she had stood before. She replayed the scene in her mind. The guy had loomed up ahead of her. The nightmare vision, face to face. In other words, he had been walking in a southerly direction, coming from the north, from somewhere near the mouth of the track. She stepped over the guy and moved on to where the voice from the dark had spun them around. Damn right about that, little girl. They had turned and seen him, face to face. He had been walking in a southerly direction, too, also coming from the north, from near the mouth of the track. They were a pair, working together. Common sense said they would have left their bikes behind them. They would have parked way back, surely, and then ranged ahead on foot. She stepped over her guy and set out walking, north. Mark saw her go. He was all set to follow. But then at the last second, in the corner of his eye, he saw what she was stepping over. A dead man. Two dead men. Which put things in a whole different perspective. Burning the motel was bad enough. It was insured, ironically. But obviously he wouldn't risk a claim. Even a cursory inspection would call it arson. Because it was. At the time, Stephen hadn't understood what he was watching. To be fair, none of them had. At that point, the radio was still working, and Stephen had described the pads of towels, and he had described Shorty's mysterious mechanical work under the rear end of each of the vehicles in turn. But the camera angles were bad, and he couldn't see exactly what the hell he was doing. And no one else had any suggestions either, until suddenly the towels were all on fire, and he was throwing them around. It had never happened in any of their brainstorming sessions, or simulations, or war games. Now he saw it should have. It was inevitable. If customers pushed for better specimens, this was bound to happen. Sooner or later, a really bold move would come about. But still, no insurance claim. The cops would come, and they would sift through the wreckage, and they would find all kinds of weird shit. But rebuilding with cash would eat up half of what they were making that night, which would be a severe blow. Although he supposed they could tell themselves they would earn it back later, and more. But still, a blow. Were there alternatives? Suddenly he thought so. Suddenly he thought, why rebuild at all? The motel was a dump. It was nothing to him. It was a junk part of some weird old title passed down from a dead guy he never knew. He didn't care about the motel. Then and there he decided to leave it in ruins. It would be much cheaper to convert a single room in the main house. It would be much cheaper to change the signs from motel to B&B. 6 new plastic letters, a little gold paint, a different kind of invitation. Should work fine. They didn't need more than 2 guests at a time anyway. The customers could sleep in tents. Part of the whole rugged experience. But dead people were a whole different category. Mark prided himself on being realistic. He felt he wasn't blinded by emotion, or ruled by sentiment, or misled by cognitive bias. He felt he made purely dispassionate judgments. He felt he was good at foreseeing consequences, like speed chess in his mind. He felt he knew what would happen next. If this, then that, then the other thing. And right then, he foresaw a whole lot of dominoes about to fall. The dead people would be missed. Questions would be asked. Data would be traced. If Robert could find people, so could the government. Probably faster. He thought, time for Plan B. Unsentimental. He walked back to his bike and rode it slowly to the house. The motel had burned to the ground. Only the metal cage around room 10 was still standing. It was glowing cherry red. The heat was fierce. He could feel it all the way across the lot. The embers rippled in the ghostly nighttime breeze, red and white and shimmering. He rode past the barn and made it to the house. He gunned the bike up the steps and parked it on the porch. He went in the front, straight to the parlor. Stephen said hello before he stepped in the door. Without looking up, he was watching the GPS. He knew Mark was in the house. Mark looked over Stephen's shoulder, at the GPS screen. Only one flashlight was showing. Peter and Robert were still static on the flanks. Stephen said, 4 of the heart monitors failed. 4 now? Mark said. Stephen switched screens and showed him the data. It was laid out as 4 separate graphs. Heart rate versus time. Each graph looked like a pencil sketch of mountainous terrain. All of them showed basically the same thing. First, elevated and consistent excitement. Then a brief plateau of extreme stress. Then nothing. Might be an equipment fault, Stephen said. No, Mark said. I saw 2 of them dead already. What? Their heads were bashed in. By Patty and Shorty, I guess. Who were clearly better than we thought. Where was this? South of the track. What happened to the other 2? I don't know, Mark said. Stephen switched back to the GPS screen. The surviving flashlight was moving down the track in the trees, close to the edge. Peter and Robert were still stationary. In a separate window, the 2 surviving customers were showing elevated but consistent heartbeats. Excited. The thrill of the chase. But no sudden spikes. No contact yet. Which ones are they? Mark asked.
Carol and the Wall Street guy.
Can we tell where they are?
We know where their bikes are. They seem to have taken up a middle position.
With the front 2 and the back 2 already gone. It's up to them now.
Who got the back 2?
I don't know, Mark said again.
This changes everything, you know. It's not the same now.
I agree.
What do you want to do?
Plan B, Mark said. Watch carefully where the flashlight goes. Stephen kept his eyes on the screen. Mark pulled a boxy black handgun up and out from under his jacket. His elbow went high, because the gun was long, because it had a suppressor attached. He shot Stephen in the back of the head, and again when the body came to rest, to be sure and certain. Plan B required a lot of both. He took the bags of cash from the closet and set them down on the hallway floor. He opened the closet's back wall and took out his escape kit. Cash, cards, a driver's license, a passport, and a burner phone. A whole new person, zipped in a plastic bag. He threw Peters and Stevens and Roberts on the closet floor. He carried the bags of cash outside and set them down in the dirt a distance away. He came back to the porch and opened the front door wide. He sawed the quad bike back and forth in front of it until it had room to fall over. He removed the gas cap and threw it away. He squatted down like a weightlifter and grabbed the frame. He jerked the bike up and toppled it over on its side, toward the house, right next to the open door. Gas gurgled out of the open tank. It made a stain, then a miniature lake. Mark threw a match and backed away and grabbed the bags and ran to the barn. Halfway there, he stopped and looked back. The house was already alight, all around the front door, the walls, the porch boards. The flames were creeping inside. He turned again and ran on forward. In the barn, he put the bags in his Mercedes. He backed it out and parked it a distance away. He ran back to the barn. To his right, the house was burning nicely. The flames were up to the second floor windows. In the barn, he hustled over to where the lawn tractor was parked, to the shelf above it, where the gas cans were kept. Five of them, all lined up, filled every time someone drove the pickup to town. Always ready. The grass had to look good. Curb appeal was important. Plan B. No more of that. He emptied the cans on the floor, under Peter's Mercedes, under Stevens, under Roberts. He threw a match and backed away, and turned and ran to his car. He set the hazard flashers going, for Peter and Robert to see. A panic signal. They already knew their radios were dead. They were looking at two brand new fires. They had no idea what was going on. They would come running. He drove toward the mouth of the track at a stately speed, past the glowing ruins of the motel, through the meadow, flashing orange all the way. He stopped in the center of the meadow. Robert zoomed in from the right side, a wide curve out of the woods, flailing the seed heads, flattening the meadow grass under four fat tires. He bumped up on the edge of the blacktop and maneuvered next to the passenger side. Mark buzzed the far window down. Robert looked in. Mark shot him in the face. Mark buzzed the window back up. Peter was approaching on the left-hand side. The same wide, swooping curve through the meadow. Exactly symmetrical. Aiming to arrive at the driver's window, not the passenger's. Which meant the Mercedes itself was between him and Robert's empty bike, and the slumped figure on the ground. Mark buzzed his window down. Peter maneuvered alongside, face to face. The gun was too long, because of the suppressor. Mark couldn't maneuver it. It snagged on the door. Peter stopped his engine. He said, "How bad is it?" Mark paused a beat. "Really couldn't be worse," he said. "The motel burned down. Now the house and the barn are on fire. And four customers are dead." Peter paused in turn. Then he said, "That's a whole new ballgame." "I agree. I mean, it's the end of everything. You understand that, right? This is going to be no stone unturned." "No doubt." "We should get out," Peter said, "right this minute. Just you and me. We need to do it, Mark. The pressure will be heavy duty. We might not survive it if we stay."
"Just you and me."
"Robert and Stephen are useless. They're a burden. You know that." "I need to open my door," Mark said. "I need to stretch my legs." Peter checked.
You have plenty of room, he said. Mark opened his door. But he didn't get up. Instead, he stopped the door as soon as the handle moldings were clear of the suppressor, and where Peter was still nicely framed in the now angled window. He shot him once in the chest, once in the throat, and once in the face. Then he closed his door again, and buzzed his window up, and turned off his hazard flashers, and drove on, down the track, toward the woods. Chapter 40 Reacher got through the next section of forest pretty quick because of the night vision. He stayed 6 feet off the track. He made no attempt to be stealthy or quiet. He relied on the mathematical randomness of tree distribution to save him from arrows. A clear shot from a distance was always going to be 100-1. At one point way far away, he heard 4 separated pops. 2 groups, a 1 and a 3. Tiny hollow pinpricks of sound. Maybe 30 seconds apart. The back of his brain said, those were suppressed 9mm rounds, fired in the open air about a mile away. The front said, or maybe there was something cooking off, possibly aerosol cans in the fire. Which was getting brighter again. It had flared up once, when he figured the roof fell in, and then it had faded away a little. But now the glow was back, and wider, as if more than one thing was burning. He stopped. Up ahead on the left, he saw 2 quad bikes parked side by side, front end in at an angle, half in and half out of the trees. Like outside a country roadhouse. The night vision showed no riders nearby. Presumably they were up ahead, on foot, closer to the action. Like the last 2. These were the next 2. They were operating a multi-layered defense. 1 pair after another. Which was why Reacher had avoided the infantry. He didn't enjoy slogging through endless terrain. He moved on, quieter than before. He stopped again. He saw a guy up ahead, on the other side of the track, about 30 feet in the trees. Small in the distance, but lit up even-handedly, like everything else. Delineated with exquisite care, in fine gray and green lines. Clothes like a scuba diver. A bow. A cyclops eye. No sign of his partner. Some signs of anxiety. Mostly about the glow in the sky, Reacher thought. The guy kept looking toward it and ducking away. Maybe a crude measure of how bright it was getting. How soon he had to flinch away. The guy was tall and substantial, and his head was up and his shoulders were square. But he wasn't comfortable. Reacher had seen his type before. Not just in the army. No doubt the guy was a big deal alpha male at whatever it was he was good at. But right then, he was out of his depth. He was twitching with confusion. Or resentment. As if deep down he couldn't understand why his staff officers, or his executive assistants, hadn't taken care of things for him a damn sight better. Reacher moved up through the trees, on the other side of the track. He moved slowly and quietly, all the way to where he was exactly level with the guy. Reacher was 6 feet in the trees. Then came the track. The guy was 30 feet in on the other side. A straight line on a plan, but not a clear shot in a forest. The guy was too deep. He had boxed himself in. Too defensive. He had no natural avenue of attack. Reacher walked across the track, dead on line, 100 random trees between him and the guy. He stepped back into the woods on the other side, and he worked his way through, now 20 feet from the guy, still dead on line. The glow in the sky was amplified 20,000 times, and it winked and danced through the leaves, like camera flashes, like a movie star stepping out of a car. Up ahead, the guy was looking down. Maybe the sparkle bothered him. Now, he was 10 feet away. Reacher eased his speed back to nothing. He took a good look around. A full 360. He studied the picture, section by section. Highly detailed, fine-grained, monochrome. slightly gray, mostly green, a little cool, a little wispy, a little fluid and ghostly. Not quite reality. In some ways better. No sign of a partner.
Reacher moved on. As always, he believed in staying flexible. But as always, he also had a plan, which in this case was to stab the guy in the neck with an arrow, which would be easy enough, because arm's length was game over. But flexibility intervened. Up close, even in glimpsed slivers between trees, it was clear the guy was worried in a particular kind of way, an elemental way, like a billionaire whose plane crashes on an uninhabited island, or whose car gets in a fender bender in the wrong neighborhood. The food chain, suddenly not as high as he thought. Maybe ready to make a deal. Reacher rushed him, and the guy reacted by jerking his bow up. Probably nothing more than animal instinct, not a considered decision. Which was a shame, because just in case Reacher had to scythe his arrow down, like a knife on a stick, to slash all four of the guy's left-hand knuckles. The guy howled and dropped the bow, and Reacher stepped real close, their optical tubes colliding, and he kicked the guy behind the knees so that he fell over on his back, whereupon Reacher flipped the guy's night vision up with his foot, and then jammed the same foot on the guy's throat, and forced the tip of the arrow between his lips, and tapped it on his teeth. "Want to talk?" he whispered. The guy couldn't answer in words, because of the arrow jammed against his teeth, or in gestures either, because of the foot jammed against his throat. Instead, he kind of nodded with his eyes. Some kind of desperate plea. Some kind of promise. Reacher withdrew the arrow. He asked, "Who are you hunting?" The guy said, "This is not what it seems." "How so?" "I came here to hunt wild boar." "And what are you hunting instead?"
"I was deceived."
"What are you hunting?"
"People," the guy said. "Not what I came for."
"How many people?"
"Two."
"Who are they?"
"Canadians," the guy said. "A young couple. Their names are Patty Sundstrom and Shorty Fleck. They got stranded here. I was tricked into it. I was told wild boar. They lied to me."
"Who lied to you?"
"A man named Mark. He owns this place."
"Mark Reacher?"
"I don't know his last name."
"Why didn't you call the cops?"
"No cell service here. No phones in the room."
"Why haven't you run away?" The guy didn't answer. "Why didn't you stay in your room tonight and refuse to participate?" No response. "Why are you nevertheless stalking around in the dark with your bow and arrow?" No answer. "Wait," Reacher said. He heard a car up ahead. He saw bright, jagged shards of amplified light coming through the trees. A big vehicle with its headlights on. He flipped up his tube. The world went dark, all except for the track, 30 feet to his right. It was all lit up, like the inside of a long, low tunnel. Twin high beams were punching forward. A Mercedes rolled by. It was shiny black, a big SUV, shaped like a fist. Its taillights showed red for a moment. Then it was gone. Reacher dropped his tube back in place. The world went green and highly detailed again. He shifted his foot on the guy's neck to make room for the tip of the arrow. He steadied it against the welt of his shoe and exerted modest downward pressure. The guy tried to scream, but Reacher trod harder and stopped him. The guy said,
"I didn't know what I was getting into, I swear. I'm a banker. I'm not like these other guys. I'm a victim, too."
"You're a banker?"
"I run a hedge fund. These other guys are nothing to do with me."
"I guess the world has moved on," Reacher said. "You seem to expect better treatment because you're a banker. When did that become a thing? I guess I blinked and missed it.
I didn't know they were hunting people.
I think you did, Reacher said. I think that's why you came. He leaned harder on the arrow, and harder, until it pierced the skin, and drove down through the neck, clipping the spine, and out again the other side, pinning the guy like a dead butterfly against the forest floor. Against a tree root, by the feel of it, gnarled and hard. But Reacher strained and leaned and pushed until the arrow was solidly rooted and perfectly upright, like a monument. Then, he moved on through the trees. Mark stopped his Mercedes nose to nose with the tow truck. He had run the numbers. There was a maximum 4 people technically still unaccounted for, who were Carol and the Wall Street guy, plus Patty and Shorty themselves, plus, hypothetically, a 5th person, if the outside pair had been victims of a 3rd party. Of the big guy, perhaps, come back again, because he had spotted something, because he had been unconvinced. Peter's fault. 4 people. Or 5. All up ahead. Maybe a long way ahead. He needed 3 short minutes. That was all. Maybe less. He needed to reverse the tow truck out to the road, high speed, into a ditch if necessary. Anything to get it out of the way. And then he needed to sprint back and hop in his car and blast off. To anywhere. North, south, east, or west. 3 minutes. Maybe less. That was all. But 5 people, in locations unknown, each location being either more than 3 minutes away, which wasn't a problem, or less than, which was. But it would be hard to be less than, he thought in the end, in practical terms, even with bikes. He ran the scene in his mind, like speed chess. First this, then that, then the other thing. He felt he knew what would happen. It was a loud diesel engine. Everyone would hear it in the distance. At first, the customers would assume the perimeter was being loosened, an on-the-fly in-game adjustment, to keep the fun coming. Patty and Shorty would think a version of the same thing. They had done well so far, so they would assume now the goalposts were being moved against them. None of them would be suspicious. 3 minutes didn't matter. None of them would react at all. Except Carol. It was his truck. He would know some kind of weird shit was going on. He might let it go, because he thought he was more or less a semi-detached member of the team now, after the last couple of days, as reflected in the generous discount and so on. He might feel a bit mi casa su casa about it. He might even take it as a courtesy, not to be dragged out of the game. He was there as a customer, after all, not an umpire. It wasn't his job to make on-the-fly adjustments. He might let it go. Or he might not. He might be more than 3 minutes away. Even if he reacted immediately, he would need to thread his way through the forest, possibly 60 yards or more, back to wherever he parked his bike. That could be 3 minutes right there. Or not. Realistic. Dispassionate. Overall, he figured there was a good chance of success. Either Carol would let it go, or he wouldn't. Multiplied by either he was close by, or he wasn't. 2 coin tosses in a row. Disaster priced at 4-1. Success at 4-3. Numbers didn't lie. No cognitive bias. He left the Mercedes running, and he left the driver's door open. He squeezed between the trees and the truck's enormous hood. He battled his way to where the cab towered above him. He grabbed the handles and climbed the ladder. The door was locked, which he had not foreseen. For once, he hadn't known what would happen. Such a simple thing. It had never occurred to him. Not in a million years. He hung there, 1 foot on a step,
one hand on a handle, swinging free, poked by trees. At first he was angry. Carol was stupid to leave the truck without the door open and the key in. Who the hell would do that? It was insane. Flexibility was everything. They might have needed to move the truck at any time. In-game management was always fluid. Everyone knew that. Then, he got worried. A sick, hollow feeling. Where was the key, if not in the truck? The best case was bad enough. The best case said the key was in Carol's pocket, which meant finding the guy and taking it from him, which would create a delay. Potentially a long delay, which would in turn increase his exposure to any remaining hostile elements. Not good. But it was better than the worst case. Carol's pockets were tight, stretch fabric, shiny black. Would he want to carry a key? Would any of them? They had left their rooms open, after all, to Shorty's great advantage with his flaming towels. They hadn't wanted to carry those particular keys. Maybe they thought lumps and bumps in their pockets spoiled the look. The worst case said Carol had left the tow truck key on room 2's dresser, to be picked up in the morning. Now, to be picked up never, or years in the future as a lucky find, ashy, melted, twisted out of shape, purpose unknown. Mark climbed down the ladder and forced his way along the hood to his car. He reversed 10 yards and turned around in the hole in the trees and drove back the way he had come. Patty saw him pass by again. She had seen him leave minutes before, if it was really him. She was only guessing it was Mark in the car. Because of the night vision, she hadn't looked at the driver directly. The car had its headlights on, way too bright. But as she ducked away, she heard the hum of its engine and the whoosh of its tires. She knew it was a regular type of car, or wagon, or SUV. She just felt it was Mark inside. Running away, she thought, the first time he passed. But evidently not, because he came back again. Maybe it wasn't Mark after all. She couldn't find the quad bikes. She didn't think they would be deep in the trees. The spaces were too tight. It would be too easy to get wedged in forever. So she confined her search near the edges of the track. She expected to find them parked side by side, maybe backed half into the bushes, maybe angled as if ready for action, but also leaving space for others to get by as a courtesy if they wanted to. But she found nothing. She stopped walking. She was already a long way from Shorty. She didn't know how much further she should go. She looked ahead, carefully. She was growing accustomed to the night vision. She turned around and looked behind her. The glow in the sky was bright again, too bright to look at directly. She half turned back and checked to the south. She saw a small nocturnal creature skitter across 6 feet of open ground and dive into a pile of leaves. It was lit up the same as everything else, a pale, wan, scuttling green. Probably gray in real life. Probably a rat. She turned all the way back around. She looked ahead again. There was a man in front of her. The same as before. The same nightmare vision. Out of nowhere. Out of nothing. Just suddenly there. With a bow held ready. The string was drawn back. The arrow was aimed, but not the same as before, not at her legs, this time higher. No Shorty behind him, not the same as before. The nightmare vision spoke. "We meet again," it said. She knew the voice. It was Carol, the weasel with the tow truck, from the Yugoslav army, who looked like a blurry face in the back of a war crimes photo. She should have known. She was stupid. Carol asked, "Where's Shorty?" She didn't answer.
Didn't he make it? Or maybe you don't know for sure. Maybe you went your separate ways.
You ain't a pair right now. He ain't up ahead, because I checked. He can't be behind you, because that would be neither use nor ornament.
She looked away.
Interesting, Carol said. Is he back there for a reason?
She didn't answer. He smiled under his glassy snout, wide and delighted. He said,
Is he wounded?
No reply.
This is exciting, he said. You're out gathering roots and berries to make a potion to heal your man. You're worried. You're anxious to get back. This is a truly delightful situation. You and I are going to have so much fun.
I was looking for a quad bike, she said.
No point, he said. My truck is parked in the way. No one gets out of here before me. I ain't dumb.
He lowered his aim to her legs. No, she said.
No what?
Yes, Shorty was wounded. Now I need to get back to him.
How bad was he wounded?
Pretty bad. I think his thigh bone is broken.
Shame, Carol said. I need to go see him now. The game says freedom of movement depends on not getting tagged.
Please, she said.
Please what?
I don't like the game.
But I do.
I think we should quit. It has gotten way out of hand.
No. I think it has gotten to the good part.
Patty didn't speak again. She just stood there, with her flashlight in one hand and her arrow in the other. It was the working flashlight, not even the weapon. The arrow would be good for slashing or stabbing, but the guy was 10 feet away. Out of range. He drew back the string an extra inch. The arrowhead moved backward, the same inch, toward his hand, clenched tight around the grip. The bow curved harder. It sang with tension. It was the working flashlight. All in one movement, she dropped the arrow and found the switch and lit up the beam. It was like she remembered from the first time, checking on the Honda's heater hoses. A bright, white beam of light, hard and focused. She aimed it right at the guy. At his face. At his big glass eye. She lit it up and pinned it down. He flinched away, and his arrow fired wide and low and thrashed through the undergrowth and thumped in the ground. He ducked and squirmed and twisted. She chased him with the beam of light like a physical weapon, jabbing, thrusting, aiming always for his face. He fell to the ground and rolled over and tore the machine off his head. She switched off the flashlight and ran through the trees.
Chapter 41.
Patty knew running would turn out either smart or dumb, depending on whether Carol caught her or not. Simple as that. At first she was hopeful. She was running well, and she figured he might be slow to get going. He might worry a little about an ambush up ahead with the beam of light, like a space movie on Shorty's TV. Then, bad news. She heard crashing feet behind her, getting closer. She darted right and changed direction. Carol was slower to turn. She got ahead of him. He caught up again. He got to where he was just behind her. Up ahead in the bouncing night vision, she saw the track. Coming up, closer and closer, bright and clear. She was running toward it.